You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Good afternoon, Hot House. How are we this afternoon? Are we feeling good? Are we in the room? It feels like we're not quite all here yet. I know the feeling after a couple of days in a tent and the wind and the rain and all the rest of the things we've contended with. Nevertheless, it's great to see you here. I'm especially pleased to welcome Alice Robinson to speak to us this afternoon. Alice is the author of Field Fork Fashion, is thinking about sustainability and farming, especially to do with leather. She's a designer and artist. Her work has been extensively shown, and we're really privileged to have her here at Greenbelt. So I will let you hear from Alice rather than from me. And Alice, we're really pleased to have you with us.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and I'm really delighted to be here. Sadly, I've only just arrived and I'm absolutely gutted. I haven't been able to be here since Friday, and I hope everyone has been having a good time. I'm here to talk about a book that I have just published, but actually the work that has gone into this book is something that has been quite a personal journey for me as somebody who wanted to train to be a fashion designer since I've been a small child, and learning that the act of making clothes is far more connected to many more industries than what we think of when we walk into a shop. So a little bit about me, my background. I've driven up, driven down today from Shropshire. I've grown up there my whole life, on the border of North Wales, so not too different from Northamptonshire. Many small local farms. My father was a farm vet, and my mum was my sports teacher at my school. For if anyone who has had a parent be their teacher at school, it was a great experience, and she really pushed me to explore creating and making clothes. And I really didn't associate my more rural upbringing to creating fashion and design until I started working with leather, which is slightly the topic of this conversation, because leather is one of the materials that is unavoidably connected to the fashion industry. It is intimately connected to how we produce food. And it was a material that really sparked my interest in how my actions of what I choose to create as a designer has impacts to our food choices and to the landscapes and communities of people that are really begin where that material originates from. Fashion is very much known to be one of our biggest contributors to very destructive impacts that we have around the world, whether that's poor working conditions in the global south and very destructive industrialized supply chains that are producing the main materials that we use. And I really was quite confronted with that when I began studying after 7 years training in women's wear and moved to the Royal College of Art to do my master's degree. And that was when I was introduced to leather as a material to work with. So I had trained to make garments, and I really wanted to be creating clothing that was going to last a really long time. And so I decided that I would change my degree to be able to study accessory design, to try to create items that would last a lifetime. And that was when I was introduced to leather. So I don't know if anybody has ever looked at the items that they own, whether it's a belt or a pair of shoes, and you've ever thought, I wonder where this material originated. I wonder what animal this began with, and what farm that was, and what were the practices of that farm? What was the food that was behind that animal? Why was this produced in the first place? And how is that connected to the product that I have in front of me now? So I'm going to read a really short extract from my book that hopefully tries to put into context some of the questions that I was wanting to explore within working in a different way with leather. For 2 years, my commute to the Royal College of Art involved travelling through one of the most opulent streets in London, Sloane Avenue. Twice a day, my journey provided a sumptuous encounter with luxury fashion's finest. Sitting on the top of a deck of a bus where I could get the best view, I'd snoop through the window and appreciate the bags on top of polished glass cabinets. Each brand's name debossed and engraved on stunning craftsmanship stated its claim. Many of the leathers behind the shop windows were impervious. Glossy coatings hid any evidence of imperfection. Multiples of the same design sat in stores on every continent, each providing identical offerings. These pieces were seen as the pinnacle of luxury fashion, but what set them apart? I began imagining that they were interchangeable, laid out on an assembly line before a brand's name was added or a label stitched in. What had come before their adopted identity? I began to wonder about these items, viewing them not as products of a brand, but as an extension of something else, agriculture. What was the story, and how could it be framed, presented, and valued? Informed by the knowledge that leather originated in food systems, I aimed to explore how that connection could influence my work as a designer. I decided that in order to find answers to my questions, I'd need to follow it as a product from the field and confront its transformation into food and fibre. So those questions that I was presented with early on in my degree led me to do something that at the time was seemed quite drastic. So I was in a cohort of 52 designers that it's very competitive at fashion universities. I don't know if anybody's heard horror stories of people sort of sabotaging portfolios or hiding people's work, but that is really kind of what it gets down to at some points when you're doing your master's degree. And at the beginning of our final year, each of us had to stand up and say what our final collection was going to be. So if you study women's wear, you have to create sort of 10 outfit looks and they go down a catwalk. If you are studying footwear, you create 6 different pairs of shoes. And if you are studying accessories like me, I was supposed to be creating a collection of handbags. So everybody stood up and they described what the theme or motives were behind their collection. We were taught by a very inspirational woman called Zoe Broach, who really believed that in the time that we are in, to create something new, we really need to be able to justify the reason behind it. It can't be just because we want to make a new beautiful t-shirt or a really flamboyant dress. There really has to be a motivation that we can defend behind it. And I felt very strongly about that. And so I stood up and quite shyly said, "I've bought a sheep." And everybody gasped. And I sat down very, very quickly. And we all had to bring 2 photographs to this tutorial where we sort of would show this was what we're going to go on to be influenced by. And I brought in the picture of a sheep from a local farmer with an ear tag that said 11458. And I vowed that in that tutorial that I would learn what it meant to work with the fibres that were connected to the landscape that I grew up around, and with an understanding of what it meant to work with those materials. And I wanted those to dictate what sort of collection I was going to be bringing into the world. It was a very sort of scary moment for me because I had only ever gone into our store cupboard. And I don't know if anybody, a keen sewer's here, but when you get to go to a fabric store and there's sort of rolls and rolls and rolls of beautiful fabrics and you've already got in your mind, I'm going to design a dress that looks like this, or I'm going to make something, and you've already decided what that design is. I really wanted to have my design process be a collaboration with an understanding of where these materials were coming from, what the extent of them was, what the thickness was, what the micron was, and therefore what I was going to make. So I only have a small photo of what that collection looked like. It was made up of 1 small handbag, a pair of gloves, and a year later I added a jumper to it. I worked with a spinner who spent over 18 months carefully carding and spinning the entire fleece of sheep 11458, which was a Welsh mule crossed with a Texel ram. The micron was really quite coarse, that I think people would say, oh, it's only suited to carpets. But she spun it really beautifully into two ply. And I then worked with a knitwear designer, and we only had so much material. So I said, start knitting the pair of gloves with both hands at the same time and stop when you run out of wool. So as a result, they turned into sort of like racing driving gloves. But actually, everybody else who was far cooler than me at university were like, wow, I love that design. Like, it's so different. And I was like, oh, well, you know, it was intentional. But it was things like that that I felt that you can sit and ponder over all of these decisions, but really being dictated by or influenced by or having an appreciation of the limits of what you have to work with and a parameter to work within felt very liberating for me. I, a year later, added a jumper to the collection, and I had a small amount of leather left, just enough to make a pair of shoes, but not enough to make the soles of shoes. So if you see leather on the soles of shoes sometimes, they are, that leather is always made from a larger animal like a cow or a buffalo, not from sheep leather. And so I only wanted all of the materials that went into this collection to come from sheep 11458. So I went into the, I can't remember what they called it now, but it was a laboratory really that you could go in and basically grow or make anything out of plastic or resin or things like this. And so I went in and asked, can I use these tiny scraps of leather and create molds for the soles of the shoes and pour in the tiny pieces that couldn't have been utilized to make a product, but could I then make the soles of the shoes instead? So I added a pair of shoes to the collection that utilized every single last scrap. And everything, well, the closure of the bag was also made from a tiny bone that was electroformed in silver to really give an understanding of the animal that had created this piece of work. Everything, instead of being parceled out into boxes, you know, when you get your shoes and they're in one box and you've got your hat in one box, I created just one box that this entire collection would sit within. That box and that size of that box was really representative of the animal that was behind the collection. When I showed this piece of work, it was for my graduate show, and I decided that to want to have the accountability of the items I was putting out into the world, I also bought the carcass of the sheep. So I worked with a butcher, and we butchered the entire animal. We had one celebratory dinner with my family to talk about the work and to really appreciate what I was doing. And spoke a lot with my uncle, who was a very conventional arable farmer. And this is sort of 7 years ago. And we were really starting to have conversations that I hadn't thought about before that were really connected to my practice. And with the rest of the carcass, we served 350 mini burgers at the launch of the collection. Which was quite terrifying. I stood up on a stage and I said, before you is the former home of sheep 11458, on a big screen behind me that had a very beautiful tree that had fallen down, and you could see the remnants of wool hanging from it. And it was a really beautiful image. And then people were really confronted with this smell coming from behind them, and behind them was waiters holding all of these mini burgers. And for me, this was a really important moment to try to understand the feelings I had to working this way, what it was making me confront that had never been proposed before, that fashion kind of sits outside of the decision making of farming and our food system, and what it meant to put ourselves within that system by valuing those materials or being able to question where they come from. I will always remember a student coming up to me who was supporting on that show, and she ran up to me and she goes, Alice, I'm so sorry. And I was like, oh gosh, what's happened? And she goes, I think I've really upset somebody, and there was a lot of scary fashion people there. And she goes, this lady came up to me and she said, I'm really offended by this girl. I'm really offended by what she stands for and what she's just spoken about, which was never my intention. And this lady was furious and said to this student, you know, sort of how upset she was. And the student just said, I'm sure that isn't her intention. And I would just like to point out that you're wearing Margiela tabby shoes that are made from pigs. And this poor student goes, I'm so sorry. I just couldn't help myself. And I was like, if there's one thing that I was trying to do was just to have those sorts of moments of, you know, having a new perspective and trying to have a look at the connection that there is there. And for me, that was a really important start. I did that piece of work and then I really should have just gone and got a job. And my mum was like, so 7 years, going to go and get a job now, Alice? And I thought, oh, I will. But I feel really strongly that I want to understand more about how this industry that is incredibly impactful that I want to work in is connected to the land that we see, the environment that we have, and the food that we eat, especially when I'm thinking about this material, which is sort of hailed as this incredibly luxury material. Like, you can buy an Hermes bag for £25,000, but you can't know the name of the farmer that raid the animal on what sort of land to what sort of benefit for any part of the environment. And so I felt, I've just started learning. And that journey led me to the farmer who is the focus of this book. And he's a farmer called Malcolm Adams. And I went home after creating collection 11458 and I was talking to my family, and my dad, as I mentioned, was a farm vet, and he had four sisters who all lived close to us in Shropshire and Cheshire, and every member of our family on that side works in either farming or agriculturally adjacent professions, like veterinary surgeons or are in arable farming. And they said that if I wanted to continue this sort of research, then I need to meet a farmer called Malcolm Adams. Excuse me. And he owned a small herd of longhorn cattle. So Malcolm Adams lived around a 15-minute drive away from me on the border of North Wales. His family had lived in that part of the world since the 1800s, and they'd always been a mixed livestock farm. And he had learned everything that he knew about farming from his grandfather and they had before. And he'd won many conservation awards for how he had produced food at Charity Farm. And he happened to have purchased, when my dad was still alive, after my dad passed away, he had a small herd of longhorn cattle. And if anybody is a native breed fanatic, longhorn cattle are native to the UK. They are a breed that have been around since the medieval times, and they have evolved really to be very well suited to marginal landscapes and being able to live outdoors their whole lives. They look incredibly majestic. They have like a brindled hide and they have a white finching line down their spine and these huge horns. I travel up to Northamptonshire quite often for work, and there is one farm around here that keeps some native breed longhorns. So if you're ever looking outside of a train, keep an eye out for them. And this farmer, Malcolm, he has been producing food for our local community in Shropshire and Wales for the last 50 years. And the way that he was caring for livestock, for producing food for his community, was something that I felt personally that I wanted to support. And so I wanted to understand, what does it look like to work with this farmer? And what does it look like to, what does fashion look like produced from this farm? We all awake? and so I asked, I went to meet him, and to his credit, he was like, yeah, get in the Land Rover and let's go around the farm and let's meet the herd. And I want to understand more about what you're talking about. Because it felt a very foreign concept for for me to turn up and say, you know, tell me everything. And I don't know if anyone's a farmer here or speaks to a farmer, but being a farmer is very much who you are. It is not something you do as a job. It is who he was as a person. So I was asking all these questions that sort of in a job interview, you can ask somebody about their day to day or sort of about their work. But this is very much intertwined with who Malcolm Adams was as a person. And after going to visit quite a few times, I said, can I purchase the next bullock that you take to an abattoir? And I want to understand what the intricacies of this food chain and what does this mean for me if I want to work or support it? Because something that is a misconception about leather is that it is an anonymous byproduct of the leather industry. And that is historically how it's been spoken about within the industry, because the majority of cattle are reared globally in an incredibly intensive and destructive way. And hides as a product of producing food can either be utilized to make leather, or they can go to landfill, or they can go to waste. And I really wanted to understand what was happening to Malcolm Adams' hides, and if I was to work with them, what does that mean for what I can produce? And so he said, yes, you can purchase bullock 374. And sort of my journey began, and I spent 9 months following Malcolm Adams through his usual journey of producing food, understanding where he needed to take his cattle to an abattoir. And this was the most crucial moment in my education about the leather industry and about fashion, is that in order to produce food locally, for a farmer like Malcolm to get the carcass of his animal back, to either sell it to a local butcher or to, I don't know if anybody buys meat through farm boxes, in order for that to happen, there has to be access to a local small or medium-sized abattoir that can offer a service called private kill. And I'm sure nobody thought when they sat down for a fashion talk that we were going to be talking about private kill services at local abattoirs, but that is a fundamental service that farmers need to have in order for us to be able to know who is producing our food and how it's being produced. And those facilities have closed at an alarming rate over the last 10 years. There used to be hundreds. We're now down to early 50s, about 52, that are unevenly distributed around the UK. And part of those closures is because they they have to go through the same protocols as much larger facilities do, but they have much lower throughput. And one of the critical things that they have found as a huge stress is the value of hides and skins. They need to have somebody come and collect those at the end of the day in order for them to enter a leather supply chain. And small and more rural abattoirs that are offering services to farms like Malcolm are very, very underserved by those systems that are selling into a global market. So when I traveled with Malcolm to go and visit his local abattoir that was offering this service, and I said, please, can I have the hide of bullock 374 back? They said, of course, it's going to be going into the bin. We've got no one to come and collect them. And to me, that felt like the first moment of, wait a minute, in fashion and in the leather industry, you sort of are being told that this is coming from a waste product, which it is, essentially. That's what I was learning. But it's not coming. I don't have a choice in utilizing that product coming from a farming system that I also want to be supporting, because the mechanisms to enter the supply chain don't exist. They're still dominated by a very, very sort of globalized and commodity-based system. So this hide of bullock 374 that day would have just been going into the bin and not being utilized. And so the first part of my journey was to travel with Malcolm and take that hide back. I then salted it for 2 weeks and then needed to find a tannery to turn it into leather. And we're in Northamptonshire, which is, even on my drive down, I saw the sales room for Loke. I saw, we've got John Lobb around the corner. They were in like the heart of shoemaking sort of mastery. But the infrastructure to produce leather from these native breed cattle and these local farms has really disappeared over the last 40, 50 years. So now we only have three tanneries left in the UK that can produce cattle leather. And we export 70% of all of the hides that are produced by our farmers in the UK. And they are exported out into China, into India, and into Europe. And we re-import leather that isn't coming from our native cattle. And so when I really wanted to be able to work with this leather, I was confronted by the fact that even if you're a designer wanting to make certain choices, then you're really reliant on infrastructure existing. And the fact was that that infrastructure really didn't exist. And so I banged down the doors of the remaining three tanneries, and fortunately one of them let me in so that I could take the hide of Bullock 374 through the tanning process. That resulted in... These are three pieces of the leather, and the other half I kept the hair on. So a hide starts off with a hair on. I then sided it down the spine and tanned one half with the hair removed, so it looked like leather, the type of leather that everybody is very accustomed with. And I kept one half with the hair on, which you can see on the front of the shoe. And it was something that I really wanted to have as an important part of the collection, because it was an incredibly visceral reminder that these products were connected to a live animal. That was both very confronting, but really was had the same response that I got from when I was able to work with the wool and leather of 11458. I then was able to split the hide in half, so you then had suede. So you have double the amount of material that comes from one bullock. And I then designed and created an entire collection only utilizing those that leather. The result was... I really should have put a bookmark in this. Designing and pattern cutting to only utilize the materials that I had on hand. The result was... this collection that sat inside a much larger box than 11458, and making that box was almost as hard as making the entire collection. Everything about the items that were designed was really working with the type of character that came from a Longhorn Limousin cross bullock. So I used the horns from the bullock to make the buttons. I used the bones to create the buttons. They both gave an indication on the size of the animal, the breed of the animal. That's not what I was looking for. I then made decisions about how to design a collection to use smart pattern cutting techniques to ensure that it was 100% utilized. So my original training was in clothing, which came in handy because in leather, you really don't have the same weft and stretch that you have in woven materials. And really, if you make a mistake, you're really stuffed because you can't unpick it without it being seen. And so I worked for having not really planned my timing very well, 52 days before the... this collection was exhibited at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London at an exhibit called Food Bigger Than the Plate. And I designed and manufactured this collection so that it could enter that exhibition in a really tight time frame. And every single decision, again, was actually quite liberating because I couldn't design some flared trousers with a certain type of drape because the fiber structure of a 30-month-old Longhorn Limousin cross was really tight, and it's not going to work like a soft goat leather or something like that. And so I really wanted to try to understand what do these materials mean for design decisions. And there was also something that was very revealing to me, that if anybody's got any leather goods on them now, take a look and see if you can see any scratches, or if you can see any bite marks, or if you can see any evidence of the type of life evidence we have on our bodies. Like, I mean, I've got so many scars all over my legs from flying off bicycles or having a burn from cooking. And in the same way, this bullock that lived on Charity Farm out in the woodlands and on the pastures its whole life had evidence of bite marks and tick marks and brushing up against hawthorn hedgerows and scratching against barbed wire. And typically, that would make that type of leather a really much lower grade. It would either be covered in polyurethane plastic and being made to look like a plastic sort of textile, or it would be sort of buffed off altogether. So you can put like a sandpaper over leather, and it erases all evidence of that type of character. And I really wanted to have an education on these types of materials, so I left all of that bare. So as I was designing, I was seeing growth marks and trying to understand how I frame them and use that as beautiful proof of life and something that is valuable and not to be downgraded or not to be disposed of. But how do I understand why the character of this material looks a certain way? Sort of in the same way that I think with wool, as soon as you have a connection of why that breed of animal has been so appropriate to a landscape. So sort of when you have the Herdwick sheep that are perfectly bred for the Lake District because they are hardy and they can live up on the hills their whole lives. And therefore there's a beautiful celebration of the type of character that that wool then produces, and an appreciation of the sort of inherent characteristics of that, of being that very warm and durable, that I wanted to have that same appreciation of the materials that I was then working with. This work, as I mentioned, then went into the Victorian Albert Museum, and it was there for a period of months. I can't pass this around, but I also wanted to create a sense of time and place about this collection, which was kind of riffing on, you know, when you see like a Michael Kors perfume, and many designers and brands have gone into that sort of adding to their product range. Well, I really wanted to create a perfume that was representative of the time and place of life of Bullock 374 and a representation of sort of the beautiful landscapes of the Shropshire Welsh Hills. And I actually pitched that while I was at the Royal College. We did a project with Thierry Mugler, and everyone was meant to present sort of their concept. And I was like, well, I bought a sheep, and I think it would be really great if my sheep had a perfume. And I didn't win, and I still went ahead and created it anyway. And so inside this box, because you're not allowed to have perfumes dispersing at the V&A because there's incredibly expensive artwork that it can diffuse on and things. So I had to put it into a balm. But inside this box is the smell of the plants and trees and a conceptual way of trying to capture October in North Wales. And I worked with a wonderful company called Made for Life Organics, who totally got the sort of wildness of the idea. And for me, having that sensory connection that is often so often lost from when we think about leather, you think of the you know, the leathery smell of a tannery, and that is what is really evokes for people. And I really wanted to sort of go one layer backwards, sort of what is this sensory connection all the way back to land level. So feel free to have a smell if anybody wants to. It doesn't smell like cowpats, which I think some people really wanted it to. I'm just going to quickly go on to what I am working on now before if anybody has any questions. So the two pieces of work that I speak about in the book and the journey of creating them. So inside Field Fork Fashion is really a document of every stage of the journey of creating Collection 374, from meeting Malcolm to visiting the abattoir and understanding the pressures of our food system, to working with a local butcher. I butchered the entire bullock. That took 9.5 hours, if anybody has ever wondered how long it takes 9.5 hours, and it's really cold, and it takes an incredible amount of skill. And worked with a wonderful butcher called John, and he had learnt from his father. And it was really brilliant to learn sort of all of the different types of cuts that are also very much tied to different regions of the UK and different sort of crafts of how we butcher. And that was a really important part of wanting to have a responsibility for all parts of the animal. So over the course of the 9 months, I hosted dinners and events where both the leather and the food and the conversation about the connectivity between our food, our fashion and the farming communities that produce it could be explored. And that was a really exciting moment for me because I was able to give the meat to friends and family and colleagues and people in my local community. And then people would send in a recipe and a photograph and an anecdote of who they shared the food with and what was their conversation, what was the meal. And I think what was just really important for me was having this understanding of how precious these connections really are and how they, you know, how that isn't something that we can all access and how fundamental I think that that is to being able to have accountability for our choices in any sort of industry if those those points of connection don't exist. And when the exhibition closed, my mum said, "Are you going to get a job now?" And I said, "Yeah, I probably should." And so I fortunately was yabbering on much like this at a conference. And I met a woman who had been exploring this conundrum that leather wasn't connected to food systems. And she'd been exploring it in the States. And so we met and we thought, let's give it a shot. Let's see if we can. And we have partnered with an organization that certifies farms for 100% pasture-fed agriculture. They're called Pasture for Life. And they are a farmer-led organization that started over 10 years ago with a real conviction to, in their words, champion the power of grazing on pasture and what that can do for biodiversity, for producing nutritious food, for having resilience in our landscapes, for being able to hold more water, to be able to use animals, ruminant animals, and cut and work with them. So a farmer that we work with calls them ecosystem engineers, and she says the byproduct of my farming system is food, but actually the product is biodiversity, resilience, and all of these other, you know, crucial things that we need. And what I felt is that if I'm going to continue to desire to design and make a handbag, then I really want to know that that material is tied to people who are producing food in that way. And how do I support that through having an understanding of how I can purchase these materials? So we have partnered with Pasture for Life. We now have an understanding on what are the crucial, where are the services that those farm needs, i.e. the small abattoirs. How do we work with those abattoirs to ensure that those hides don't go into landfill, don't get incinerated, do get collected? So we now collaborate with hide collectors that collect those hides at the end of the day, keep the traceability of them, and then we can take them to a tannery ourselves and produce leather. And so we've been working on that now for, it sounds like that should have been a really simple thing to do. It's taken us 4 years to get to a point where we now have the relationships all along the value chain to be able to produce a material that is beautiful and durable and can be accessed by any brand maker and designer in the UK who wants to be able to sort of have the same connection to this material. So that business is called British Pasture Leather. And there's a little bit more about it here. We are now the first entity in the UK that is producing leather from the hides of cattle that are coming from farms that have regenerative outcomes, that are producing really incredible research about the practice of using different methods of mob grazing and cell grazing and grazing through woodlands, and it's a really collaborative and wonderful organization, and anybody can be a member, and they have, you know, you don't even need to be a farmer. You can just be an eater or someone who is interested. So anyone. And our goal really is to be able to have a design industry that is supporting the work that is happening on the land to create more of a resilient, sustainable and enjoyable landscape to live in the UK. So if anybody is interested, we are we have a mailing list open on the internet. It's britishpastureleather.com, and we infrequently but are trying to use Instagram, but I think I'm like the most incapable Gen Zer of using it, so I think I'm Gen Z. So we're on there as well for any other information, but if anyone has any questions, I think that's probably a lot from me.
Thank you, Alice. That's been so fascinating, and certainly for me has opened my eyes to all sorts of things I'd never even begun to think about. I'm sure there will be lots of questions in the room, so please do keep your questions brief and to the point. Do put your hand up if you'd like to ask a question, and I will come to you. If you're nearer the back, you may need to come to me because I only have so much cord on my microphone.
Okay. Hello. My name's Andrew. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the economics of the leather, because I mean it's obviously not free material, but if it's a byproduct then it kind of should be. So if you could you talk to me a little bit about that.
Hello. Yeah, absolutely. So hides do have a value. So part of a revenue stream of an abattoir is being able to sell on what is called the fifth quarter. So you have the four quarters of the animal, and the fifth quarter is made up of the blood, bones, hide and fat. And so that is all, they have always been products that a abattoir sells on to different vendors, whether that's going into cosmetics or it's going into the leather industry. And they've really depended on getting value for that fifth quarter in order for their own running costs. So when an abattoir like the one I visited with Malcolm doesn't have a industry to sell those hides into, they have to add the cost of that disposal to the cost of what they're charging a farmer for slaughter. If they do have a industry to sell it into, then that comes down from their farmers, from the farmer's fee. And so we buy hides directly from an abattoir at what the market rate should be in order for them to ensure that they are having the right value going into their overheads. We then pay an additional fee because we are asking for things like traceability to farm level that at the moment doesn't exist. So it's an extra step. But really part of how we're working is saying, you know, what do you need? We are what we're wanting to bring value to this. And we're hoping that downstream an understanding of being able to embed values throughout and share them throughout the value chain, then it's going to result in a material that has fairly compensated everybody. We also give a contribution to every farm that we work with. So a misconception has always been that farmers sell hides, but they're of abattoirs to sell. And so because we're wanting to be able to talk about those farming practices and talk about those farms, and they are a product of a farming system, we want to be giving value back to a farm as well. So we've been doing that since we began, to give a donation back to the farm for every hide of theirs that comes into our supply chain. One of the biggest challenges that we have is that globally, the majority of leather that is produced using a tanning process called chrome tanning, which is around 90% of all leather is produced using chromium salts. And that can be done in sort of a week. And we're using a traditional vegetable tanning process because we feel very strongly that we want to have a material that is going to be biodegradable and non-toxic at the end of its usable life. There is only one tannery in the UK that can contract with us to do that. We've had to work with them to understand what volume they need, how do we have our own traceability system, and all of these really complex things. And the result is it takes 3.5 months to produce this type of leather. And the assumption within a design community or sort of a design industry is that leather is a cheap and abundant commodity that costs very little. And so one of our biggest challenges is that producing something domestically through a different type of value chain results in a material that at the moment is in a different bracket to a material that has been produced in high volumes very quickly and benefiting from a global commodity system. So I hope that answers sort of from the farm level economics, but also the challenges that we're facing economically as well.
What you're saying about the economics of buying leather reminds me a lot of the economics of buying meat, that when it's produced at kind of mass quantities, it's really difficult to do it ethically. If you do it ethically, it ends up really expensive, mm-hmm. and it sounds like exactly the same sort of thing. And a lot of people who are working in the, you know, kind of with how can we be more sustainable with meat say what we really need is everyone to have use much, much, much less.
Yeah.
Is that sort of where you're going with this? Is that kind of, am I making the right kind of conclusion? Because what you're talking about sounds like out of most people's affordability.
I mean, one of the really interesting things that we've encountered is that the proposition that we're making of a material that's being produced through British pasture leather is that it's suited to startups and new brands who are considering how they want to produce differently as well. Whether that is you buy one pair of shoes once and they've got a repair and return scheme, or they've got they've envisioned how to design for circularity and things like that. And I completely agree with you. I mean, what's really frustrating that I hear when I speak to farmers is that, you know, they can't afford their own food but that they produce. And that is, like, that's a fundamental question that we need to be thinking about, is that we're not producing things for a echelon of elite that isn't unfair. But what we're hoping is that it isn't inconceivable for us to be able to produce this type of material with these values attached to it in a way that is more accessible. But in the first instance is that we've really not held on to the infrastructure and industries that we need locally or domestically in order to have a shot at doing that. We've got rid of our production a long time ago. So in order to bring that back on shore, and it is a really exciting opportunity, and for smaller makers, for local manufacture, it's a challenge that we have to keep on trying to evolve and make more accessible. But it's something that we have to keep in mind, but it can't be a reason not to try to then make it more accessible and affordable. And also, my bugbear's always been, like, if you're producing a £3,000 bag and somebody's buying that bag, have that leather at least coming from somewhere where a supply chain like ours.
Hello, Alice. I feel like I'm having to confess something now. My name is Matthew. Fantastic project, really interesting, thank you. I just wondered what had happened to collection 11458 and 374. Where are they now?
So collection 11458 was acquired by the Victorian Albert Museum in 2019. So if anybody ever wants to go and have a look at it, it's in their permanent archives, which I think you can... you can just book and go and see things there. I've not yet gone and seen it yet. But fortunately, thank you. Fortunately, there was a wonderful lady who came to see it at my my graduate show. And she said that it was a really important piece of work that they wanted to have in the archive. So fortunately, that's there. And unfortunately, Bullock 374 is still with me at home, and it's much bigger. So I probably should have said to them, can you take the bigger one? But I'm actually really delighted that Bullock 374 collection is still with me, and it's been has gone to different exhibitions and shows. So the hope is that I would like it to be shown at more museums and being more accessible. And I'm sure my mother would be delighted with that as well.
Just wondering, did you make your boots?
No, they're from Vintage. They're Vintage Clarks.
Hi, Alice. Thank you for your talk. I've got something really kind of a bit left field, but let's see how we do. Firstly, I'd love to help you with your Instagram, because that's what I do. And I'd just love to have a coffee. I don't know where you live, but somehow. Right, here's my random question. I missed the start because I was just talking to someone, but I do marketing and branding, and I have rejected the algorithm and Mark Zuckerberg. I think he's the devil, probably. And I try and live by the year. And my model for marketing is taking something to market. And I was really interested to hear what you had to say, because I wonder how far away is the farming year to God's idea of nature and what would happen without us doing anything. I'm Katie, by the way.
Nice to meet you, Katie. Thank you. Well, interestingly, that's been something that we've had to really try to explain to brands that have wanted to work with us, where there's going, oh, great, love what you're doing. Can I have 10,000 square feet next week? And we're like, no, because we are working very much with the farming calendar year. We're also working with an understanding of the natural processes to produce leather that in through a vegetable tanning method that takes a very long amount of time. And what I am really interested in is that when I first worked in this way with my collection when I was at the RCA, and we had timelines when we were at university that you really had to stick to, like tutorials and crits that were just in the diary, where you needed to have twirls by a certain day or mock-ups by a certain day, and I would turn up with nothing because my sheep was still alive. And so I couldn't. And I think that's something that's really important when we're thinking about different types of systems and different approaches to design, is thinking about actually the cycles of different industries as well. So the way that we're approaching bringing this leather to market is the availability of it is very much tied to the farming system. And then we are wanting to release it in a way that is true to its process, which is a real big push and pull, because people want to know what the samples are for autumn winter 2025, 3 months ago. So it's, but I think that's where it becomes very exciting, that I think the doldrums of the fashion cycles don't work. And I think to propose new systems, we need to be thinking about it holistically again around all of those industries. So be delighted to have a coffee.
Hi, sorry. It seemed a lot of it hinged on the infrastructure. Are there any projects that we can support around reopening abattoirs and tanneries in the UK?
Yes. So there is a campaign for small-scale abattoirs that is being run by the Sustainable Food Trust. They've done a lot of work on that over the last 5 years. They've got some really brilliant reports out, called one of their ones that is has a lot of information in it is called A Good Life, A Good Death, and it's accessible on the Sustainable Food Trust Guide. They are now developing upon that to work with the Abattoir Sector Group, which is led by a man called John Metrick. And they are now working with DEFRA to have new strategies for sort of the different verticals within that that we can support. And one of them that I'll be working on is how do we create this proposition for new infrastructure that is supporting those small and medium size abattoirs. So what we're working on at the moment is trying to have an understanding of sort of what that cost scale and places are. So yeah, I will happily share what those developments are and sort of where to support them. There is a save one specific abattoir, which is closing, called Long Compton Abattoir. And if you really want to like support something that is active at the moment. There is an abattoir in Longcompton that a group of farmers are campaigning to save, and you can buy a share for £1, £10, and that's how they're sort of getting it back on its feet.
Rightio. Hi, Alice. Thanks for a very interesting speech and talk. I've got a question about the ethical side of things. Is there anything unethical that you think is from what you do? What would you see as unethical?
That's a great question. I feel like I'm resting the majority of the ethical question on respecting the decisions of the farmers that I'm working with. I feel like for me to sort of have found where my opinions are on the ethical line, especially when we're talking about raising animals for food and really what that question really is, I've tried to approach that by having an understanding on what the consequences of that have been, and also how to ensure I am really valuing all parts of that animal, and my responsibility is on the material side. And I would say that the 30-month rule in the UK of not being able, having to slaughter cattle before 30 months, even though we've sort of on the veterinary side and the safety side of that moved forwards. When we're talking about having the right breed of animal on land, a native breed animal thrives for many, many, many more years than 30 months. And I feel like what is maybe not unethical but unfair is that we have to place economics within an ethical choices, and that these farmers are taking cattle that young when they are still thriving in order to have a economically viable business. So it's not really a great answer to your question, but I would say, like, to me, that's a, when I took Bullock 374 to the abattoir, he was 27 months, so 3 months before being OTM, and that didn't feel right. And so I think that's something that I feel less in control of, but something that I think about a lot.
Hi, this is just more of a general question beyond like the basic fashion advice of, you know, getting your stuff on Vinted and buying secondhand and all of that kind of stuff. Do you have any tips on buying more sustainably or those kind of things, you know?
Something that I have, this is probably a bit of a personal bugbear, but I think understanding the construction of a garment, as in what the fibres are that have gone into it and how those processes are made, is something that I think goes really to the heart of the what should we be wearing and how can I make more sustainable choices, because I'm a Vinted fanatic. Everything I own is from Vinted if I can. And but it's full of it's full of petrochemical clothing, and something that I really feel strongly about, especially in the UK, is that we have such an opportunity to be connected to the people who are producing our fibres, because we have a landscape that produces food and animals that are suitable for a grassy landscape, and we have incredible native breed animals that produce beautiful wool clips that are not being brought value to, but there is really innovative farmers that are now wanting to bring them to different markets. So I would say that, like, beyond the sustainable question, I don't think it's for the brands to sort out. I go to a lot of fashion materials fairs, and people are presenting new materials to work with. And inside those design, inside those design houses, everybody's looking for, like, what's the best decision that I can make to make a new product go out there. And then we've got customers going, which brand should I be buying for? But I think going behind that is sort of having a look around and trying to think about fashion less as a silo of like that it's something that we get from a shop or on a shelf, and really it's something that is being produced all around us, and having more of a an education to that. That to me, that's been a way that I feel more like more accountability on making those decisions or where to try and make them.
Thank you very much. And I'm afraid that's all we've now got time for. So it just leaves us to give Alice an enormous round of applause. That's been an incredible session.
Thank you very much for staying. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.